You are listening to 93.3 FM WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio. Coming up next, a show the NSA always loves to listen into, and stop tapping my phones. This is The Mike Cannon Show.
Warning. The views expressed on The Mike Cannon Show, or the segments brought to you on this indie media radio show, do not necessarily reflect the views of WNRB nor WNRB's host.
Guess who's back again.
Mike Cannon.
This is my boomstick!
This could be dangerous. You should go back.
I know you're out there. I can feel it now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change.
Heads up.
Mr. President, last year you said if the Iraqi government asked us to leave, we would. Well, now they're asking for a timetable for withdrawal.
Yeah, see, but they don't really mean it. I know Iraq. They're just playing with us. Their words say leave, but their eyes say stay. Set up permanent bases. Have some no-bid contracts for our oil. Plus, they're not getting any younger. They don't really want to be sovereign, all alone. Tick, tick.
But they...
We ain't leaving.
And now, the only radio commentator not addicted to illegal pain medication, nor Viagra, Mike Cannon.
Welcome back to this week's fully independent, non-corporate radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. For well over 2 years now, The Mike Cannon Show has been bringing you alternative voices from around the country and the world. Voices the six mega corporations that control 90% of all television, newsprint, and radio do not bring you. This show is produced for not-for-profit community and micropower radio use worldwide at the Glee Glee Studios. Special welcome to two new places that is airing part of my little ditty, RadicalRadio.org and KLGR 95.3 FM in Boulder. This show and other items I produce can be found at RadioForAll.net, and if you are a Pacifica Radio affiliate, you can download it using their archives. By the way, RadioForAll.net is used by other not-for-profit producers, but can be used by anybody. They've just updated their server, and the download times seem to be working better. Make sure you update your browser to help avoid any glitches. All us independent producers owe a great deal of thanks to all the efforts at RadioForAll.net. By the way, I'd love to hear what you think about the show. Please consider dropping me a line at themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. Cannon is spelled C-A-N-N-O-N. We'll get into the lineup right away this week. The first hour features a great weekly news and review segment from the folks at Eat the State. You'll also hear a segment I produce for not-for-profit airways called This Week's Iraq Body Count and This Week in Radical History. I'd like to shorten this week's Iraq Body Count. Funny how those on the right love their sports teams, know the scores of last night's game, but can't tell you the number killed in this war of aggression. Well, they listen to this week's Iraq Body Count, at least they could know that number too. When we have the time, we bring your other short independent not-for-profit radio shows like Media Minutes, Radio Spin, Women's E! News, Ask Mr. Green, Peak Oil Check-In, to name a few. However, I normally cannot fit them all into the first hour, so they go to the second half of the second hour, right after the show I bring you each week called This Way Out, an LGBT news magazine. The third hour this week will feature a non-Zionist, non-Western point of view, This Week in Palestine, and World Report out of Canada. Often World Report tells us more about what's going on in our country, much more so than the Main Street corporate news programs in the lower 48. This week, once again, they'll be talking about the American war resisters seeking asylum in Canada, something you almost never hear about in the United States. You can also look forward to more music of love, rage, and resistance here and there, as well as a little bit of goofiness. Let's get into this week's show. And as always, I'd like to thank you for taking some time out of your day to listen to this fully non-corporate, fully indie media radio program, The Mike Cannon Show.
You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Heads up!
Senator Obama, you voted to give President Bush everything he wanted in regards to FISA, giving immunity to the telecoms for their lawbreaking, trashing the Fourth Amendment and civil liberties, legalizing mass, unsupervised, warrantless wiretapping of Americans. So why? Is this some kind of turn to the center?
And why shouldn't he? It sure worked for me.
And me.
That's right, cause nothing makes Americans want to vote for Democrats more than when they act like Republicans.
Barack Obama has racked up a shocking number of betrayals of progressive ideals in the last several weeks. but his latest foray into the sewers of right-wing ideology puts him at the very heart of strategies developed by George W. Bush's presidency. By embracing so-called faith-based public policies, Obama has aligned himself with the most right-wing forces in American society. First, a brief history of what Bush calls his faith-based initiatives. Early in his presidency, Bush adopted two schemes developed by the far-right Bradley Foundation of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. One would allow churches and other religious organizations to use public money to take over public services to the poor, while at the same time cutting funding to public sector services in disproportionately black, poor constituencies. The other Bradley Foundation project that became Bush administration policy was to provide public funds to private schools through vouchers. Many, if not most of these schools, would be run by churches. Together, private school vouchers and church-based social services became the central domestic policies targeting black America under President Bush. Vouchers and faith-based services were the Bush regime's tools of political outreach to African Americans. It would be more accurate to say that the two initiatives were designed to carve out a black Republican constituency for Bush, where none had previously existed, by offering billions of dollars in public funds to black preachers. In a word, Bush would build a black Republican base through bribery. To a large extent, it worked. Bush's faith-based initiatives and private school vouchers dangled unprecedented billions of dollars in the faces of the black preacher class, and many were eager to cash in. The scheme was especially effective among previously non-political Pentecostal clergy, many of whom suddenly became aggressively right-wing in pursuit of federal dollars. It is widely believed that Bush garnered record-breaking numbers of black votes in states like Ohio in 2004, based on mobilizations of black ministers tied to faith-based Republican money. As should have been expected, Bush's lavish use of public funds to solicit greedy ministers created grave divisions among black clergy, revealing a deep corruption in ministerial ranks. Now, Barack Obama has again shown himself to be a rank opportunist, eager to use George Bush's corrupt scheme for his own benefit as he seeks to attract voters deep in right-wing circles. In the process, he will further the split in the black church and the African-American body politic as a whole, with the inevitable result that the progressive black tradition will be battered and weakened. Once again, Obama has proven that he isn't about change, at least not change for the better. He has become a convert to Bush's kind of evangelism, bribery on a huge scale, under the guise of religious faith. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Heads up.
My friends, I can't believe Senator Obama is against offshore drilling.
But Senator, it's not like the oil is just going to be given to us. The oil will go to multinational oil corporations, which will make billions and billions, while the average American consumer maybe will save a penny or two off a gallon of gas in a decade or so, while having their environment denigrated and polluted.
And who would be against that? I drink your milkshake!
You are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3. It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Dude, these are good headphones.
Mine feel like they're going to fall off.
All right. Well, next week you guys can switch.
Head. Yeah, I want mine back next week.
All right. All right. Moving on to national and the EPA and greenhouse gases.
Oh, Lord. Oh, you want me to talk about
yeah,
that?
Yeah, you talk about that.
Okay, well, the EPA has announced yesterday that it's not going to enforce any greenhouse gas emission regulations before the end of the Bush administration. This has been reported in most news accounts as the EPA's decision, but it's not really the EPA's decision. It's the White House's decision, and they have made it impossible for the EPA to pursue what really has been required by a Supreme Court ruling that was a a couple years old now, that requires that greenhouse gas emissions, which have been scientifically shown to have an adverse impact on human health, fall under the, I believe it's the Clean Air Act.
Clean Air Act, yeah.
And therefore the EPA has a legal responsibility to develop regulations for regulating them. And this is something that the White House has been extremely resistant to, as it's generally been resistant to anything around climate change or global warming. And now the EPA is just throwing up its hands and say, look, until we get somebody in the White House who believes in science and, you know, reality and good things like that, there's absolutely nothing we can do. They won't even open our emails.
Yeah, yeah. So until we have regime change in Washington, D.C., nothing is going to get done about global warming.
By the way, my favorite bumper sticker of the week, support our troops, we'll need them to overthrow our government.
All right. Well, EPA is complaining that the White House won't open their emails, but the Senate this week voted for exactly that, opening everybody's emails.
Yeah, it's a pity that they can't apply the surveillance rules to the White House itself. But unfortunately, you know, who's going to watch the watchers and all that? The Senate caved on the FISA regulations. They basically gave the Bush administration everything that they wanted, which is remarkable considering not only that Bush is extremely unpopular and a lame duck president, but the Bush administration tried to get a nearly identical bill through the Republican-controlled Congress 2 years ago and couldn't do it. But with Nancy Pelosi and Henry Reid shepherding the bill through the Democratic Congress, Bush has been more than happy to sign it. It really is a striking capitulation and failure of leadership on the Democratic side, and unfortunately that includes Barack Obama.
Yeah.
All right. And also this week, the Guantanamo prisoners having their day in court.
Oh, yeah. For the first time, the Guantanamo detainees got their first day in a real court. There was a 3-hour court hearing in front of Federal Judge Thomas Hogan. He's the guy who is listening, who is hearing these. He's listening, yes.
He's listening now. Yes.
He's hearing
part of that surveillance thing.
He's hearing on behalf of other federal court judges the 200 cases for Guantanamo Bay detainees. And basically what's at issue before him right now is the Justice Department wants about 8 weeks to get together all of the evidence and provide it to the lawyers for the Guantanamo detainees. In addition, they want time. They want extra time to update and add to the evidence. And Hogan appears to be questioning the need to do that. That if the government didn't have adequate evidence in the first place, why'd they hold these guys for so many years? He basically held out his hand and shook his finger at the government lawyers and said, "Look, set aside every other case that's pending in your division and address this case first." So basically he said, quit stalling. These guys need their day in court.
Yeah. Did the news account specify which finger he was wagging?
No, no, that was me saying, look, you know, that was me doing a little bit of editorialism there. But basically he scolded, really gave them a good scolding and said, you can't stall any longer. These guys have a right to a trial by jury. Let's get it done.
All right. Well, speaking of wagging their fingers, the G8 met this week.
Yeah, the G8 at the G8 summit. The big issue at the G8 summit really was trying to come to some kind of agreement on limitations on greenhouse gases. And at the end of the day,
brace yourself. This is going to be a big surprise.
Yeah, all they came up with was we support setting some kind of goal eventually on reducing emissions by maybe about 50% by 2050. But there was no set goal. There was no discussion of how to go about it or anything. And the interesting thing about this immense failure on the part of all these nations to reach any kind of an agreement is that it was depicted in the U.S. media as being developing nations like India and China who were dragging their feet about setting a goal. When in fact, what happened there was China and India said to the G8 nations, we are willing to set a goal of reducing our emissions by 50% by 2050. If you in the West, particularly in the U.S., commit to some kind of reduction, they didn't specify how much, some kind of reduction in your greenhouse gas emissions by the year 2020. That's what they said. They said, we will reduce our emissions by 2050 if you commit to reducing your emissions by 2020. And basically, George Bush sat there and squirmed, and he said, I can't do that. I won't do that.
Yeah, it was really the U.S. who dragged their feet in these negotiations. The other important part of this, and bear in mind that the science is telling us that we don't need a 50% reduction by 2050. We need an 80%.
80 to 90%. Yeah.
Is that this is a process that has been designed by the United States to compete with and overshadow the process, the much more comprehensive process that's being negotiated through the United Nations. This is George Bush saying, we in the industrialized North, and particularly the United States, are going to call the shots on any kind of international agreement to control greenhouse gases, and we don't care what the rest of the world thinks. And unfortunately, because despite the increase in places like China and India, the United States in particular is still by far the largest producer of greenhouse gases. I've said it before and I said again, of all the crimes against humanity that have been committed by the Bush administration over the last 8 years, I think historians, if there are any left, are going to look back at these years and say that the greatest crime that was committed by these people was their intransigence on global warming at a critical, critical time for global cooperation.
All right, moving on, Iraq.
Yeah, interesting developments this week on the security pact that's been secretly or not so secretly rammed down the throat, negotiated by the United States and Iraq. Prime Minister Maliki came out this week sort of recognizing political reality because the Iraqi parliament isn't about to sign off on any kind of such agreement and said that Iraq would not sign a security agreement with the United States unless it included a specific timetable for U.S. withdrawal of troops. This has been the first time that the Iraqi government has specifically said not just that we would kind of like to see these troops leave eventually, but demanded a timeline and tied it to an important piece of policy that the Bush administration wanted. And of course, the United States rejected that out of hand, saying we want to leave that decision to the commanders. Of course, no input available to the country that's actually being occupied. And it clarified very much that this is not the Iraqis who want us there for security. This is the United States imposing its will.
All right. And Afghanistan.
Yeah, an interesting development this week in Afghanistan, where once again a U.S. airstrike killed a bunch of civilians going to a wedding party. In this case, 47 of them.
Happens a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, this is a pattern of mass civilian casualties from U.S. airstrikes that has happened again and again in Afghanistan, and it's become an extremely sensitive political question because, understandably, Afghanis are not very enthusiastic about this. What's more interesting is this story was almost entirely ignored in U.S. media, and very telling is, for example, the AP headline that was used on this story. They did report it, although that report was not run in most of AP subscriber newspapers. The headline that they gave it was, quote, 47 Afghan civilians killed by U.S. bombs, group says. Well, that implies that it's some sort of a NGO making this accusation, and it's maybe not particularly credible. It wasn't any group that was saying it. It was the Afghan government that was saying it. Yeah, they deployed a commission to investigate this bombing and came back with the conclusion that it did in fact happen, that it did kill a lot of civilians, in contrast to what the U.S. claimed, that no civilians were killed. And unfortunately, the U.S. is going to keep doing this as long as U.S. media keeps whitewashing these stories.
And very quickly, treaty with the U.S. and Czechoslovakia.
Yeah, the U.S. signed a treaty with Czech Republic, signed a missile shield treaty this week to put in place a radar system to presumably protect the U.S. from attack from missiles from Iran, which is kind of laughable. This is something that has been seen as very provocative with Russia. The U.S. is also negotiating similar treaties with Poland Poland and Lithuania right now. In retaliation today, Russia has cut down the oil supply to the Czech Republic. So we're going to be hearing a lot more about this in weeks ahead.
Sit back, relax, breathe in. Slowly, there you go. Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show.
FISAgate. The majority in Congress may have stopped fighting for the Fourth Amendment, but the battle is not over. Today, the ACLU, along with Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, The Nation magazine, and former New York Times reporter Chris Hedges, filed suit in federal court to block the new foreign intelligence surveillance law. The lawsuit says the law makes legal dragnet surveillance and mass acquisition of phone calls and emails of U.S. citizens. Today, July 10th, 2008, President Bush signed the FISA bill into law in the Rose Garden. As Senator Russ Feingold said to us last night, one of the greatest assaults on the Constitution in the history of our country. The purported justification for this assault on the Constitution is the threat posed by terrorists. Terrorists who, our president tells us, hate us for our freedoms. Freedoms we're now abolishing ourselves, we say because of the looming terrorist threat. If this is winning, what would losing look like?
Mad world. Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. It's been a brutal couple of months for the newspaper industry as the sagging economy and more online choices for reading and watching the news takes its toll on the printed page. The Los Angeles Times announced huge cuts in its workforce, newspaper sections, and story lengths. 150 jobs in both the print and online news departments will be eliminated. By the fall, entire sections of the paper will disappear and story lengths will be shorter. And three other Tribune Company papers, the Chicago Tribune, the Baltimore Sun, and the Hartford Courant, also announced deep cuts in staffing. McClatchy, owner of several newspapers, said a 10% company-wide staff cut was planned. Newspapers across the country are reeling from deteriorating credit conditions, slowing home sales, dwindling advertising sales, and higher gas prices. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is cutting 1,300 full-time jobs. The Boston Herald expects to lay off up to 160 employees. Convergence of news and print operations are also contributing to the job cuts. The Detroit News and Detroit Free Press hope to reduce their staff by 7%. The Tampa Tribune's newsroom convergence with WFLA Channel 8 will force 21 people out of their jobs, mostly in the editorial department. In May, Media General, the owner of Tampa Tribune and WFLA, announced an 11% cut in its workforce across its many media outlets. About 750 jobs will be lost. And the Cleveland Plain Dealer, owned by Condé Nast, will eliminate 32 pages a week from their paper. Four regular weekly standalone sections of the paper will be cut, including Monday's business section. The paper will also shrink its daily opinion columns from 2 to 1 page. For years, kids have been collecting sports cards as a way to learn about their favorite players and talk about the game with their friends. Now they can trade cards depicting a different kind of hero, media heroes. Reclaim the Media, a Seattle-based grassroots organization that works for social change through media justice, is recognizing the accomplishments of 21 journalists, activists, and media innovators that have had a lasting impact on media and democracy. They've created a set of media hero cards. Executive Director Jonathan Lawson.
We've been thinking about our media heroes, the people who we admire and who inspire us to do what we do as media activists, and thought this would be a fun way of recognizing a series of important media activists over time, and also it would be a really kind of an interesting teaching tool.
Lawson, who did most of the research and writing for the cards, says the heroes represent different types of media activism by a variety of people throughout American history. He's hoping the cards will broaden the historical and educational perspective of media activism.
Somebody who maybe knew Bill Moyers or Democracy Now! And be attracted to the cards for that reason, but then they would get an opportunity to find out about somebody who they might find inspiring but hadn't heard of before, maybe Ruben Salazar or Ida B. Wells or somebody of that caliber.
Lawson says the media heroes are guiding lights for today's activists.
We're working within a developing social movement where it's can be kind of counterintuitive to think about who our heroes are. But I think for people who want to change the world for the better, there's nothing more empowering than knowing that we're not alone. In fact, that media democracy, media justice didn't just appear out of nowhere, that social change is the product of social movements. And the heroes of these movements, especially our movement, are so many and are incredibly diverse. And so these cards are really a way to inspire people by knowing about the great things that have been done in the past.
For more information about the Media Hero cards, go to reclaimthemedia.org.
The American Civil Liberties Union and the Electronic Frontier Foundation filed a lawsuit in federal court last week asking that the Department of Justice turn over records concerning the DOJ's tracking of mobile phone users. The filing says that U.S. residents should have a right to know about tracking done by U.S. attorneys' offices. The civil liberties groups say that the tracking may be unauthorized and potentially unconstitutional surveillance on American citizens.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national, nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
This is my boomstick!
The Mike Cannon Show, normally heard Mondays from 2 to 6.
I'm with another gentleman here who's at the anti-Nazi protests. And I wonder...
This is Mike Cannon. I'm with Becca, who has returned from Palestine for the fourth time.
I'm with a vendor at the energy fair here who has biodiesel.
This is Mike Cannon. I'm with a group, the RNC Welcoming Committee for the Republican National Convention that's going to be coming up.
Need is still here, even in Algiers, where a lot of the community businesses aren't open, and it's 100 times fold that in huge swaths of this town, like in the 9th Ward, where almost nobody's back because there's no infrastructure set up there. So
stay current. Listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
And you too can stay current by checking out the Mike Cannon Indie Media Radio Show, normally heard every Monday from 2 to 6 p.m. on this, your only not-for-profit, commercial-free community radio station, 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio.
Gonna rise up, take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution.
This week in radical history for the week of July 14th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, some audio borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York, and more radical info came from the Daily Bleed website.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This week in radical history, starting July 14th, 1764, Conspiracy of the Equals member and precursor to the French anarchist Jean-Francisque Vallée is born. Vallée hated the dictator who in essence took over the French revolutionary government and his excesses, as well as the middle class running of the country after King Louis is deposed. Speaking of the French Revolution, happy Bastille Day. In 1798, storming the Bastille heralds the French Revolution, begun by Parisian crowds seeking arms and the liberation of political prisoners. It signals a new period in history with the taking of power by the capitalist class and French bourgeoisie. The people of Paris stormed the prison of Bastille, symbol of tyranny, federal authority, and divine right of kings. The revolution creates a formidable enthusiasm not only among the French working class but also around the world. Unfortunately, the middle class gains control, its power displayed in a basket of guillotines and totalitarian temptations, leading to reaction and empire and various wars of conquest, all in the name of freedom and revolution. In our own revolutionary freedom-loving country in 1798, Federalist Sponsor Sedition Act made it a crime to write, utter, or publish any false, scandalous, or malicious statements about the government, Congress, or the President. Anyone open against the government throughout the country were promptly arrested. Let freedom ring. On July 14th, 1811, working-class people around England start to organize against what they see as business taking advantage of them with their expensive machines. Known as the Luddites, the workers organize and have nighttime raids on business-owned machine shops. The government quickly moves to make it a capital crime to destroy machinery. Also on this date in 1912, Woody Guthrie, people songwriter, is born. Woody crisscrosses the nation, living and singing among the dispossessed. Over the course of his life, he composed over 1,000 ballads and celebrated, in his songs and his prose, the great human spirit. His songs included This Land Is Your Land, Bound for Glory, Union Made, and other American Revolutionary classics. On July 14, 1916, federal authorities demand removal of the office of anarchist journal Mother Earth from its location at 20 East 125th Street in New York. Being good anarchists and not wanting to violate the letter of the law, they promptly moved the Mother Earth offices down the street. Also on July 14, 1935, black Americans in Harlem, New York, begin demonstrating in support of Ethiopian struggle against Italian fascism. They also start to organize volunteer brigades to go over and fight. Also on that date, 1937, because of high casualties while fighting the fascists in Spain, predominantly anarchist volunteers in the Lincoln and Washington battalions merge into one brigade, known as the Lincoln Brigade. Lastly, for July 14, 1998, 28 Foodnot bombs and homeless activists arrested in San Francisco United Nations Plaza during a nonviolent direct action demonstration seeking to reclaim public space and parks, which is increasingly being made inaccessible to homeless people. This week in Radical History for July 15th, 1205, Pope Innocent III says Jews are doomed to perpetual servitude and subjugation due to the crucifixion of Jesus, a view still held by many religious kooks such as Mel Gibson to this day. Also on July 15, 1963 in New York, anti-draft riots end after 3 days. Over 1,000 dead in riots, including many free blacks, attacked and murdered by Confederate sympathizers. Of course, if you had enough money, you could buy your way out of the draft. Not much has changed in military service to this day. More news in Land of the Free in 1917. Alexander Berkman and Emma Goldman and many others indicted under the new Espionage Act for their anti-draft activities. Berkman and Goldman would get 2 years in prison and fine $10,000. Also on July 15, 1917, 50,000 lumberjacks strike for an 8-hour workday. Also on that date in 1918, U.S. intelligence agencies begin to circulate the names and addresses of over 8,000 Mother Earth subscribers, targeting them for investigations. Reluctantly, they decide it is better to close a Mother Earth bookstore than to let the government continue to harass anarchist subscribers. On this date in 1919, the U.S. War Department announces that it is classifying more than 337,000 American men as draft dodgers. Also on that date in 1958, Marines invade Lebanon to protect American interests. Also on July 15, 1974, appearing live on a Florida TV station, newswoman Christine Chubbuck finishes reading the news to her Florida audience and says, "And now, in keeping with Channel 40's policy of always bringing you the latest blood and guts, in full color you're about to see another first, an attempted suicide," unquote. Reaching into a shopping bag behind her desk, she pulls out a revolver and shoots herself in the head. Propaganda the deed on live TV. Two more items for July 15, 1978. The longest walk, transcontinental walk by Native American Justice, begun on February 11th, arriving in Washington, D.C. on this date from Alcatraz Island, with over 30,000 marchers. Also on that date, 1985, animal rights activists begin a sit-in in the National Institute of Health to protest funding of experimental head injury lab at the University of Pennsylvania where they'd be willing to bludgeon monkeys in the head for their research. This week in Radical History for July 16th, 1099, following Christ's teaching of love thy neighbor, crusaders herd the Jews of Jerusalem into a synagogue and set it afire. Also on July 16, 1439, in England, a kissing ban is enforced in an attempt to stop the spread of pestilence and disease. The prohibitions fail as people only pay it lip service. It's all kind of tongue-in-cheek. Also on July 16, 1835, 2,400 Cherokees shipped out of Montgomery, Alabama, for the Arkansas River as part of the forced relocation of all Indians in U.S. territories west of the Mississippi River. Basic consolidation of over a century of the theft of all Indian lands to the east, primarily through bribery, theft, murder, cheating, and looting, and an unending string of broken legal treaties. Preparations for more of the same to come to the west in coming decades. Also on July 16th, the Great Railroad Strike of 1877 begins, with a wildcat strike of 30 railroad firemen in Martinsburg, West Virginia, protesting wage cutbacks and escalating into 2 weeks of national workers' rebellion against the railroad industry and federal government. Riots killed dozens in the Midwest and East Coast, and strikers briefly seized the city governments of Pittsburgh and St. Louis. Workers without unions to tame and control them successfully stopped the trains for 3 to 4 days to as much as a week, while destroying and seizing property and even, quote, managing, unquote, as if it was their own. Also on July 16, 1927, Nicaragua, first collective aerial bombing in history by U.S. warships occur as a precursor to the invasion of that country to protect American interests.
No more Iraqs, no more Kosovos, no more El Salvadors. These are not isolated incidents of stupidity. They're part of a long, bloody history of foreign policy being conducted for the financial interests of the wealthy few. It violates our Constitution, it endangers our national security, it mortgages our future, it sacrifices our children. It must stop. The men and women in our armed forces protect our borders and our people, not the financial interests of Folgers, Chiquita Banana, Exxon, and Halliburton.
No, Virginia, there is no Santa Claus, no Great Pumpkin, no Easter Bunny, and no Tooth Fairy. And as though that weren't bad enough, here's another shocker. The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case. And so we give support to repressive governments in South Korea and Brazil and Chile because it is in our national interest to do so. We will supply sophisticated weapons to backward countries and betray an entire people like the Kurds, all because it is in our national interest. What may be difficult to accept is that there's nothing new about that. In fact, it's what we hire our Secretary of State and our Foreign Service to do for us. The myth is that since the First World War, we were ever able to conduct our foreign policy any other way. And at best it is naive, at worst hypocritical, that they don't understand what's involved in that harsh reality. I'm Ted Koppel in New York.
Also on July 16, 1934, beginning the San Francisco General Strike, 127,000 workers participate. A longshoreman strike spreads and becomes a two-day general strike, paralyzing and forcing a settlement by the government and the capitalists. Also on this date in 1936 in Barcelona, Spain, the anarcho-trade unionist of the powerful CNT starts to distribute weapons to the workers to counter the intimate threat of the right-wing military coup, and the Spanish Civil War begins. Quoting them, "We had a clear impression that if the politicians feared fascism, they'd fear even more the people armed." Read George Orwell's Homage to Catalonia for a great book about the anarchist times in Spain. People, the times
come. This is your Radio Works reporter, Hannah George. On this day, July 16th in 1944, 11 years before Rosa Parks, a 27-year-old black woman named Irene Morgan refused to give up her seat to a white passenger on a Greyhound bus. The driver stopped the bus in Virginia and summoned the sheriff, who dragged her off the bus. Although Morgan resisted the sheriff, she was eventually arrested and charged for resisting arrest and violating Virginia's segregation law. Morgan took her case to the Supreme Court, and 2 years later, it was decided that segregation on interstate travel was unconstitutional. Despite this ruling, southern states refused to accept the desegregation of interstate buses and trains.
A couple more items for July 16th, 1945. The first atomic bomb explodes in Trinity Site, New Mexico. Never given notice to the civilians living downrange from the site, days later the U.S. had dropped two nuclear bombs in Japan. The U.S. is the only country in the world to use nukes on civilian population. Also on this day in 1946, notices are tacked to the doors of black churches in Georgia reading, "The first nigger who votes in Georgia will be dead nigger." True southern hospitality. Also in 1973, in another obvious violation of international law, the Senate Armed Service Committee begins probed into allegations that the U.S. Air Force had made 3,500 secret B-52 bombing raids into the neutral country of Cambodia. Lastly, on this date in 1987, Nicaragua, in the first major action since Ali North's effort to make them folk heroes, the Contras kill three children and a pregnant woman. Ronald Reagan illegally financed these Contras and argued that the American citizens should aid them, bizarrely comparing them to the Abraham Lincoln Brigade of the 1930s, the American primarily anarchists who fought against Franco and the fascist insurgents. These are the same Contras who ran drug rings to finance their attempts to overthrow the legal government. This day in radical history for July 17, 1794, the Whiskey Rebellion begins with a mob of 500 armed men protesting a new excise tax on small distilleries, but not large government-influenced and controlled distilleries, clash with troops at Fort Pitt. Within 3 weeks, 15,000 uniformed U.S. militia enter into the fray after the strikers fired upon U.S. revenues collector and burned down his home. This would be the largest internal fighting since the founding of the country. Also on July 17, 1862, Congress authorized President Lincoln to accept blacks for military service. U.S. Army can use blacks as laborers as well. Over 186,000 African Americans serve in the Union Army, with 38,000 losing their lives fighting the South's slave owners. Also on that date in 1917, the Justice Department instructs the attorneys and special agents to keep tabs on local Wobblies, IWW, Industrial Workers of the World, and acetate their plans, sources of income, and any data that might link them to anti-war activities. No incriminating evidence surfaces, however. It was the FISA bill of its time. People, the times
come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, July 17th in 1944, a huge explosion at the Port Chicago Naval Ammunitions Base in California killed 320 Navy men and injured 390 others, the majority of whom were black. World War II was a particularly controversial time for black soldiers in the U.S. Armed Forces, which were still heavily segregated. Many black enlistees were assigned to Port Chicago to load highly explosive materials onto Navy ships, despite being untrained for this task.
They encountered rampant racism and poor work conditions and were deliberately uninformed of the dangers they faced. The month following the explosion, black sailors at Port Chicago staged the Port Chicago Mutiny in an attempt to resist the Navy's racist policies.
Two more items for July 17, 1997, Italy. Cops raid anarchist centers and homes across the country. The Italian Anarchist Federation denounces the raids as a thinly veiled attempt to intimidate and criminalize the movement. Also in 1998, New York Times reveals reports admit CIA worked hand-in-hand with drug trafficking around the country. This week in Radical History for July 18th, I got four items. 1879, Rose Pastor Stokes is born. She'd eventually be sentenced to 10 years for writing anti-war letter to the editor. Also on July 18th, 1913, book burning in Seattle, Washington as sailors destroy the IWW, Industrial Workers of the World, Union Hall, busting windows and burning books they found there. These guardians of freedom, liberty, and the American way also ransacked the Socialist Party headquarters. Also on that date, 1969, proving no one is above the law, Senator Ted Kennedy offers Mary Jo Kopchne a lift home at the in Chappaquiddick, Massachusetts. Kennedy drives off a dike bridge, killing an unmarried 28-year-old passenger. Kennedy left the scene of the accident and reported nothing to police until the following day. People, the time
has come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, July 19th in 1979, the Sandinista National Liberation Front overthrew the Nicaraguan dictator Anastasio Somoza Debayle. The U.S. had appointed his father as head of the newly established Nicaraguan National Guard in 1933, which had been established by the U.S. Marines as they withdrew from Nicaragua after 7 years of occupation. The Somoza family quickly took over the country, representing the wealthy Nicaraguan elite and U.S. interests for most of its corrupt 46-year reign, and violently squashing any political resistance by murdering thousands of citizens. Many members of the family were educated and received military training in the U.S. and regularly assisted the U.S. with imperialist political and military ventures in the region. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
This week in Radical History, on July 19th, we only have one item, 1692. In a land based on religious freedoms, five Massachusetts women are executed for witchcraft. Quickly this week in Radical History for July 20th, we only have a couple items. 1848, the Declaration of Sentiments begin the women's suffrage movement in New York. Also on July 20th, 1874, General Custer and his first official exploration expedition enters the Black Hills with 150 wagons and 1,000 men in direct violation of the Treaty of 1869 that barred whites from the Sacred Hills. Treaties? What treaties? We're the U.S. government. We don't abide by any treaties. Also on July 20th, 1944, German officer plots to kill Adolf Hitler and staged a coup. Colonel Klaus von Stauffenberg left a briefcase concealing a bomb at Hitler's feet during a meeting. The bomb killed four people, but a table leg shielded Hitler. Also on July 20th, 1997, Honduras, announcement of more mass graves of leftists found in military sites by the U.S.-backed government. Lastly, on July 20th, 2001, Carlo Gallini, a 23-year-old Italian activist and anarchist, dies during a demonstration against the G8 summit in Genoa. Gallini was killed in a clash between protesters and Italian military police, who shot him and then ran over his body with a jeep.
Undercover, literally. I told her about Cuba. I told her about Italy.
This week in Radical History is produced at the Glee Glee Studios. Welcome to two groups airing my little ditty, RadicalRadio.org and KLGR 95.3 FM in Boulder. And thanks to all those emails about my show. Got any comments about this? Too long, too short, just right? Please consider emailing me at themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. That's it for this week in Radical History. A reminder what anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman once said, if voting ever really changed anything, they would have made it illegal. And until next week, as always, I'm yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon.
Give these people a voting day every year so that they'll have the illusion of meaningless choice. Meaningless choice that we go like slaves and say, God, I voted. Oh.
sleep now. It'll hurt less in the morning.
Canada's Refugee Board was ordered by a judge to rehear an application by a U.S. war resister to remain in Canada. Federal Court Justice Robert Barnes said that mistakes were made by Canada's Immigration and Refugee Board when they turned down Joshua Key's claim for asylum. In 2003, Key served 8 months in Iraq as a combat engineer. On his return to the U.S. on leave, he and his wife and 4 young children moved to Canada to seek refuge. In 2007, he co-authored a book, The Deserter's Tale, with Lawrence Hill, about his experiences in Iraq. Joshua's lawyer, Jeffrey House, talked to us about the judge's decision.
The Refugee Board found that Joshua Key was required, on a systematic basis as a soldier, to violate the Geneva Conventions. And that decision by the Refugee Board would have led to refugee status, except the board said, no, that's not enough. He must also show that he was required to commit war crimes. The justice the other day said, no, you're wrong. Even violations of the Geneva Conventions are sufficient to give a basis for a refugee claim.
What's Joshua's next step now?
Well, we have to wait and see whether the government of Canada appeals this decision. If they do, then we'll follow along the appeal and make the same arguments in the superior courts. If they don't, we will probably have a hearing in September or October.
There are more than 200 U.S. war deserters in Canada avoiding service in Iraq. A recent poll showed that 64% of Canadians would let U.S. war resisters stay in the country. On June 3rd, the Canadian Parliament passed a non-binding resolution calling for deserters to be allowed to stay and to put a halt to deportations. So far, Conservative Prime Minister Stephen Harper, a close ally of the Bush administration, has ignored the resolution. Sergeant Corey Glass, who is due to be removed from Canada next week, has made an internet appeal to the Prime Minister.
Hello, Prime Minister Harper. I'm Corey Glass, and I'm an Iraq War veteran. I left the U.S. because of my opposition to the Iraq War. If I'm returned to the U.S., I could face court-martial, jail time, or even redeployment to Iraq. I have not been discharged from the United States military, and I'm now currently in the Individual Ready Reserve. The people of Canada support us. A recent poll shows that Canada wants war resisters to stay, and Parliament voted on June 3rd to allow us to stay in Canada. I have lived and worked in Canada for almost 2 years. I hope you will give full consideration to my case and the will of Canadian people, and please stop my deportation before July 10th. Thank you.
The July 10th deportation order is still in effect. But will this ruling by Justice Barnes help others?
I think it will primarily have an effect on people who've been soldiers in Iraq and who've been ordered to do things that are inappropriate. It's likely to have less of an impact on people whose objection to the Iraq war is simply the war violates international law, it was not defensive in nature. Those people can't really point to any specific on-the-ground order to violate the Geneva Conventions, and so they may be in a different situation. Overall, I would say the decision tells the board that it's been looking at these cases too narrowly, and I would expect there'd be a substantial number of cases that benefit from it.
Choice is an illusion created between those with power and those without.
What do all men with power want? More power.
Now they knew who was master and leader. Sheep, thought I.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Remorse for what? You people have done everything in the world to me. Doesn't that give me equal right? I can do anything I want to you people at any time I want to, because that's what you've done to me. If you spit in my face and smack me in the mouth and throw me in solitary confinement for nothing, what do you think's going to happen when I get out of here? Well, I haven't done enough. I might be ashamed of that for not doing enough. For not doing enough. For not being more perceptive. For not being aware enough. For not understanding. For being stupid. Maybe I should have killed 500 people, then I would have felt better. And I felt like I really offered society something. murderers. You've got it stuck in your brain that I murdered somebody.
We would call me a murderer.
I don't stiff. I don't pretend to sarcasm, energy, and fancy. I can, but I find more real in the world that I'm in than I do the tinsel. And the real world is the one I have to deal with every day. Believe me, if I started murdering people, there could not be left.
Chemical weapons threat. Terrorists, dangerous guys, in turn murders.
There are some who feel like that, you know, the conditions are such that they can attack us there. My answer is bring them on.
As of Monday, July 14th, 2008, 4,118 United States military personnel have died in Iraq since the start of the invasion.
Many thousands of military personnel have had grievous, life-changing injuries such as major head wounds and amputations.
Join us or die.
According to the British medical journal Lancet, over 100,000 Iraqi civilians had died since the start of the invasion.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
What do you see when you're in the dark and the demons come?
From where Winston stood, it was possible to read, picked out on his white face in elegant lettering, the three slogans of the party. War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength.
And when we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength.
I remember how the meaning of words began to change. How unfamiliar words like collateral and rendition became frightening. While things like Northfire and the Articles of Allegiance became powerful. I remember how different became dangerous. I still don't understand it. Why they hate us so much.
I want this country to realize that we stand on the edge of oblivion. I want every man, woman, and child to understand how close we are to chaos. I want everyone to remember why they need us.
People should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people. Revolution without dancing is a revolution not worth having.
A reminder of what another anarchist and feminist, Emma Goldman, once said. If voting never really changed anything, they would have made it illegal.
Cause baby, I'm an anarchist, you're a spineless liberal.
I'm not afraid, I'm gonna fight, and I'm not ashamed about getting drunk. And I don't care what you say, cause I believe in anarchy. I'm not afraid.
Anarchy in the UK!
You are listening to 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio.